not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we welcome back to the show Robin Anderson, author, professor of communications and media studies at Fordham University. We'll talk about a recent piece she wrote for FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR.org. A pandemic is not a war. We'll talk about the language of coronavirus and power. We'll also talk about the situation in Minneapolis around the murder of George Floyd. Later in the program, we welcome back Eleanor Goldfield, artkillingapathy.com. We'll speak about Eleanor Goldfield's new film, Hard Road of Hope, about the impact of coal and industry in West Virginia. Stay with us.
Thinkable crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we welcome Professor Robin Anderson. She's an author and professor of communication and media studies at Fordham University. She has written dozens of book chapters and journal articles, and Robin serves as a Project Censored judge. Her book, A Century of Media, A Century of War, won the Alpha Sigma New Book Prize in 2007. Robin is currently co-editor of the Rutledge Focus book series on media and humanitarian action, and her edited volume, Rutledge Companion to Media and Humanitarian Action, was published in 2018. Her latest book is Media, Central American Refugees, and the U.S. Border Crisis. Robin writes media criticism for FAIR, Common Dreams, and other online publications, and this year, Andy Lee Roth and I are proud to welcome Robin Anderson's contribution to our next censored annual book. Robin Anderson, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
It's great to be here, Mickey. Thanks.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Robin. You know, in late April, you wrote a piece called A Pandemic is Not a War, and you published that at FAIR, so that's from April 30. If listeners want to go and check out this article, A Pandemic is Not a War, where you explore this uncanny way that we as Americans in the United States are obsessed with war metaphors, and we're declaring war on all sorts of things, even things that are killing us somehow, like an invisible virus. Could you talk to our listeners a little bit about how you framed that piece and what you were getting at in that argument?
Well, after CNN's Eric Levinson said, gosh, they're using metaphors, and it fits in a lot of ways, because it's like an enemy who can strike at any time, and there's a battlefield and a front line, and we have to support the war effort. And I just thought that was all wrong for a pandemic. One of the reasons is that calling a civilian population to support a war requires that you demonize an enemy, and that enemy is personalized. It's Saddam Hussein. It's the communists. Of course, that's why Trump calls it the China virus, because we are virtually at war with China, with Trump at the White House. It divides the world between us and them, and it's based on conflict. What we really need with a global pandemic is global unity, certainly not divided between us and them. We're relying on research from China to understand more about the virus, and many doctors have said that we really need to work cooperatively with other scientists around the globe. And dividing the world between good guys and the bad guys does not
work. And you have the us against them section of your article. And in this culture, go back as far as we like, even just going back to the 60s, we had a war on poverty, we had a war on Vietnam, we have, you know, later on a war on drugs, a war on teenage sex, a war on terror, a war of terror. We're just obsessed with this. So I'm curious as to how do you see this kind of, this is an election year here in the United States, given that Trump, his xenophobic language, specifically China, over and over again, the Democrats are picking up on this too. Is there some kind of a pivot here where we're going to see the anti-China, anti-Russia angle between the two parties in the election feeding into this kind of frenzied us versus them mentality?
I think it's very connected. This narrative that Trump has against the Chinese fits in with his whole worldview of xenophobia. And it's very much now directed at China. And the advertisement that came out for Trump charged Biden with being, you know, a Chinese facilitator like they always do. Of course, sadly, Biden responded with, no, I'm not. I hate China as much as Trump does. So we have, again, bipartisan agreement. And when you ever hear bipartisan agreement, I got to run the other way.
It's the Cold War mentality. It's curious, historically, going back and seeing U.S. challenges and U.S. framing of the enemy and the other, Russia, China. Here we are again. It's Cold War 2.0, or it seems to dominate. And by the way, this too, as you illustrated, this is a distraction. This isn't helping anybody in the pandemic. This isn't helping find ways to treat what's happening with the coronavirus.
The other aspect of a war metaphor is that the doctors are now the soldiers on the front lines. Well, soldiers are trained and well-equipped to kill people. We frequently forget that that is the point of war and that is the point of a soldier. When he's on the battlefield, he's not stopping and crying with a family about the combatant that he just killed. So it certainly does a very big disservice to doctors and nurses and all health professionals, many of which actually started to push back on Twitter about that. And Craig Spencer speaks a language. He's a doctor who survived Ebola. He actually went to West Africa and helped save people there from Ebola. He got Ebola, which is 80% deadly when you get it. He survived, and he speaks the language of humanitarianism, and his tweets are powerful. You're with the family. They're on the phone. They're sobbing. You feel afraid. You're trying to comfort them. These are the kinds of humanitarian responses and values that doctors need, not those of a soldier. We lose the language. We go into conflict. And by framing the pandemic that way, we don't know how to accurately respond to it. And it just feeds it and maintains everything about our militarized culture.
You had aptly quoted a few different doctors and a few people that really frame this, well, counterframe, I might say, given that the status quo, the establishment media, our political culture, framing everything in terms of war, I think it's really important that rather than talk about these people who are allegedly on this front line, in many ways, it's the opposite of going to war. That's not what's going on here with healthcare professionals at all.
Our culture is so dominated by the ethos of militarism and its hierarchies and its belligerencies that we don't realize that the war on poverty is not a law enforcement or a military strategy. It's helping people, and it's about economic injustice and righting those wrongs, those long historical wrongs. And that has nothing to do with war. All of the talk about war feeds into the military budget to take all the money out of social programs, education, healthcare. The long history that we are experiencing now with this pandemic, we've dismantled our social services and our safety net. And what we find is that media really is beginning to play a very profound role in this kind of stuff. Trump's divisive media is exactly what feeds the pandemic. It was just wonderful to see that the Prime Minister of New Zealand has actually won the battle against COVID, largely attributed to her informational style and the way she told everybody every day at a press conference what to expect, what they needed to know, the science. The same thing happened in Germany. Really, we're on the front lines. Human, you know, the civilian population, we go out into the street and we are susceptible and we need to have the information. We need to know how to act and what to do.
This is the Project Censored Show. We're speaking with Robin Anderson, author and professor of communication and media studies at Fordham University. We're talking right now about an article you wrote for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting on war metaphors in the pandemic. There's one part of the article that struck me, the persuasion versus information. And you talk at one point about World War II propaganda posters and convincing the public. Can you talk about how you were using this in the article and sort of how you're using it to talk about the response to COVID and media's role in it?
One of the things that CNN said was that, oh, we've got to win the hearts and minds of the home front. Well, that in war always translates into propaganda and persuasion, meaning they push our buttons. That is a closing down of information. That's not information. So to liken that, the media is actually, in a sense, calling for their own censorship, because many, many studies, one I quoted in the article by Fair, shows that when you call for war, you close down the information and the most truthful sources. and the truth is lost in the fog of war. And the Washington Post particularly had these redone posters from World War II. Absolutely not. It's information that people need. And doctors have said over and over again, who are not only trying to work with people and help them recognize their symptoms and help them come out of it, but also help them understand how to prevent it and putting the science together globally where we can find testing procedures, where we can find a vaccine and really work to stop this virus.
That's really over the top. The remaking of the World War II posters.
Whenever you cite the war metaphor, you've always got to go back to World War II because it was the good fight. There was an identified, very evil enemy. No war has ever been like that before or since. That is why that's the dominant narrative. And really, that's what they're referencing in this blissful fantasy world of war.
You end the article with a really great quote. Mark Hertzgard, who's done really good work overall, and you were quoting a Columbia Journalism Review piece. The media, quote, should expand their definition of what qualifies as a coronavirus story to include profiteering from the pandemic, whether financially or politically. Presenting Trump as a president at war makes it easier for the administration to usurp congressional oversight and, ironically, more difficult for the media watchdog to bark. So can you comment on that?
You know, the federal government has made it much more difficult for states to get PPE equipment. They've blocked them. They're keeping the equipment for them. It's not for the states. So they're acting like the worst kind of a centralized government with no social net or no sense of collectivity and how to do this. We've seen over and over again how the Democrats are not providing a countervailing force against Trump and the GOP. And the media is not either, as long as the media go along with these convenient metaphors that fit right into this dual system that can't point out Trump's unconstitutional behavior at every level and his political advantage he's trying to take by blaming the pandemic on China. And that narrative to his base is set. They understand it. This is Chinese. It's foreign. And it's also somehow a Democratic hoax. And so it all goes into feeding his base and his potential for re-election. And that's not how you're supposed to lead the country out of a serious pandemic.
Robin Anderson, you so eloquently state at the end of your piece that continuing to present the pandemic within the usual frames of conflict and battlefields will only exacerbate its deadly effects and encourage its spread, as well as taking the country further away from the fundamental changes needed to restore American democracy after the pandemic. And again, that's a really big topic. This is not a hoax, but it's also been an incredible cover for the government to just wipe away basic rights, particularly First Amendment rights and Fourth Amendment rights, which is exactly what we saw in the Patriot Act.
They're not stopping Trump from spying on us. They're putting through a new Surveillance Patriot Act. The Pentagon actually came to the Congress and asked them for more money. What we know is the billionaires have been getting much richer as the entire country is impoverished, increasingly impoverished. They're pulling out the rent restriction orders in many states. They're pulling people off their medical insurance. There's a moment now for a vision of a possible future as people find out what's going on and the environment and the air is clean. And CO2 has been diminished by 17%. But at the same time, we can't get out on the street and protest what the Trump administration is doing by rolling back any restriction. They're allowing the bee pesticides to just go for it. They want to drill in Chaco Canyon now. I mean, this whole array of horrible stuff and just emptying out the U.S. Treasury to the billionaires and corporations. It's going to be hard to come back from this. And my point was that the business as usual with the neoliberalism, with the lack of social services, the incredible influx of money into a military economy and culture is not the answer. And we really need new visions. And I did find this wonderful quote from George Manabo, where he says in the pages of The Guardian that the government should not bail out fossil fuel or automobile or any kind of those industries. Instead, they should make sure that employees are paid and that they're not funding any more of the destructive corporations that have been ruining the globe so far.
I'd like to remind listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. I'm speaking with Robin Anderson, an author and professor of communication and media studies at Fordham University. We were just talking about an article that she wrote for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. The article is titled, A Pandemic is Not a War, from April 30 at fair.org. After this brief musical break, we're going to continue our conversation with Robin Anderson about not just Trump and the pandemic, but also we'll talk about George Floyd and many other things that are happening around us right now. Please stay with us.
I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short-head, yellow-bellied son of Tricky Dick is gonna mother her, but top so me for just a pocket full of hope. Money for dough. Money for roll.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're speaking right now with Robin Anderson. She's an author and professor of communication and media studies at Fordham University. She has written dozens of book chapters and journal articles. She is a Project Censored judge. She has authored many books, including most recently, Media, Central American Refugees, and the U.S. Border Crisis. Before the break, we were speaking with Robin Anderson about a piece she wrote for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, A Pandemic is Not a War, and some of those themes you'll see in the next Censored book because Robin Anderson also authored our news abuse chapter for Censored 2021. Robin Anderson, before the break, we were talking a little more broadly beyond the pandemic and about what's happening in the Trump administration and how this pandemic is a cover for them to roll back all kinds of regulations. Got the Treasury. Billionaires have been making out like bandits, quite literally, during all of this. But more recently, we've seen a sad but recurring series of events. And of course, I'm speaking about the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And I know, Robin, you probably have a lot of things to say about that, particularly about how media is framing this and so on.
We talked in the last segment about how the Democrats really have not provided a countervailing force for the Trump administration. They normalize him along with the media. Trump is still a legitimate president as if he were like any other president. But this president has not only emptied the Treasury and handed it over to the corporations, but he's ignited a kind of white anger based in his own scapegoating about the economics to this white supremacist base. Congress has not called him out on that, neither. A few articles are beginning to emerge now that the white protesters are coming out, for example, in the Michigan State House, where they were dressed like terrorists. That's all there was to it. However, look at the different response in the streets of Minneapolis, where the black community has finally just had enough. So much so that they are in so much grief. And after so long in the Black Lives Matter movement that Black and Latinx people are still having targets on their back. Four police officers killed George Floyd over Memorial Day weekend. As this poor man says, please don't kill me, I can't breathe. And you can hear on the videotape people saying, don't kill him, don't kill him. But they can't stop him. There's no way that was going to stop this guy. Then after he's killed by the police, they say officers were able to get the suspect into handcuffs and noticed he appeared to be suffering medical distress. That was before the tape was aired and people saw what actually happened. But then the media starts talking about, well, it was racially charged and he died in police custody. These are quotes. Why can't they just say he was killed by the police?
You and I know why they can't say that, right? Going back to Malcolm X, can't say that because then they have to admit that the entire system is grossly unjust. It's rooted in institutional oppression and inequality. It's not just the one police officer, and I'm not exonerating these people in any way, and you know that. And I did watch that. I don't like watching those videos. Of course, nobody does. But I did go back and watch it three times. Even though as a historian, I believe this, and as someone that understands these issues, I still find it somehow unbelievable that what you said, these people are so powerless against the state, and this is such a pervasive bias and a form of oppression, that the police were able to conduct, knowing they were on film, a slow motion execution while George Floyd was begging for his life. And the one officer just doubled down. And, you know, we see people go absolutely apoplectic in this country when Colin Kaepernick takes a knee. Who goes apoplectic when an officer takes a knee on George Floyd and kills him? So that knee is okay.
The double standard is now so obvious. But then in Minneapolis, the black community finally just went into the streets.
They're thugs, but the gun-toting groups, those are somehow people that are in favor of liberty. It's totally unreasonable, illogical, double standard. It's a complete hypocritical contradiction. But it's absolutely riveting that it's so blatant and in our faces. And Trump said that if the weak lefty mayor of Minneapolis can't get it under control, that he'll send in the National Guard. Here we are 50 years after Kent State, and the presidents are still talking about National Guard.
He's talking about looting equals shooting. And now we've really moved his attacks on media to another level, where you have a CNN crew on the ground, on the streets in Minneapolis, just bearing witness, moving back when they were asked to move back, and now empowered with Trump's tweets. The state police have now moved in, and one by one, they arrest first the camera guy in front of the camera, then the producer. Then they put the camera and carry it around a little bit, put it sideways on the ground. Meanwhile, we see the guy in front of the camera say, "I'll move back, I'll get out of your way." And they said, well, he was in the way. This is what they're getting away with.
I know that this is used hyperbolically and the words get thrown around, but if this doesn't reek of fascism, I'm not sure what does. It's been well cataloged, the major onslaughts against journalists. Emma Lee and Manar Hamnahawish of Mint Press News and other independent reporters in Minneapolis are on the ground reporting these things. And they're reporting things that even CNN and the corporate media aren't doing, and they're not framing it in the same way, right? So once again, we have to rely on independent journalists on the ground risking not only their jobs, they work for small outlets, they're risking their lives in this case because they don't even have the credentials of CNN. They don't have million-dollar attorneys.
The mainstream media has not come to the defense of independent, freelance, and the likes of Julian Assange, who is a journalist from WikiLeaks.
At Project Censored, we've taken heat because not only do we criticize corporate media, as you do, but Andy Lee Roth and I have come to the defense of corporate media when these kind of things happen because it sets a dangerous precedent for if they can do this to the bigger platforms and they can shut down these major, well-heeled, well-funded platforms and they can turn it around that way, the independent press is as good as squashed. There'll be no one to protect them.
I kept thinking of your post-truth world analysis, Nikki, you and all the other wonderful analysts at Project Censored. When they take the guy's camera after he says, "I will move," and then they take his camera, it's being taped, more of what they've said, and then they just think they can lie. And if no one counters them, then they can, because it's now a post-truth world because of all the foundation laid about the justification of neoliberalisms and Fox and then Trump, and now this is where we're at.
The big lie. It's pretty riveting. We certainly live in some strange times. I suspect that you're thinking about writing something about what's happening in Minneapolis.
It focuses and culminates a lot of the stuff that's been going on. The whole history of how this handheld media that citizens have in their hands has been the only thing. And if you think about it, that has been a powerful corrective. However, in the age of the pandemic, we still have this profoundly embedded institutional racism that you were talking about before. For example, when even Mayor de Blasio, who has created a whole campaign around let's reform police, allowing the NYPD with its whole history of stop and frisk to do law enforcement to keep people apart and keep them socially distancing. 81% of the people who have been cited or jailed because of it are African-American. You can see the police at gatherings of white people, and they hand them out masks. And the black community in our town, because I live in New York, is getting a very different treatment.
Unfortunately, Robin Anderson, it's the same very different treatment we see between the protesters at the state capitals and the people on the streets in Minneapolis. Well, right. Robin Anderson, we're out of time for this segment, but it is always good to touch base with you. Robin Anderson, author, professor of communication and media studies at Fordham University, also writes for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, Common Dreams, and other online publications. Her latest book is Media, Central American Refugees and the U.S. Border Crisis. Robin Anderson, thank you so much for joining us again on the Project Censored Show today.
It was great, Mickey. Thanks for inviting me.
Up next on the program, we will be rejoined by author, writer, producer, artist, all-around raconteur, Eleanor Goldfield. Please stay with us.
Welcome to the United States, land of the thief, home of the slave, the grand imperial guard where the dollar is sacred.
Hold on, give me one right here, hold on.
You don't give money to the bums on the corner with a sign bleeding from their gums. Talking about you don't support a crackhead. What you think happens to the money from your taxes? The government's the addict with $1 billion a week. Kill brown people habit. And even if you ain't on the front line, when master yell crunch time, you right back at it. Man, look at how you hustling backwards. At the end of the year, add up what they subtracted. 3 out of 12 months, your salary pay for that madness. Man, that's savage. What's left? Get a big ass plasma to see where they made Dan Rather point the damn camera. Only approved questions get answered. Now stand your ass up for that national anthem. Welcome to the United States, land of the thief, home of the slave, the grand imperial guard where the dollar is sacred and power is God.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we welcome back Eleanor Goldfield. Eleanor Goldfield is a creative activist and journalist. Her work has appeared on Free Speech TV and in print via Mint Press News, Roar, Popular Resistance, RT, and more. She's the co-host of the podcast Common Censored, along with Lee Camp. Her first long-form video piece, Hard Road of Hope, covers past and present radicalism in the resource colony known as West Virginia. Besides touring, performing, and media work, Eleanor assists in frontline action organizing and activist trainings. You can see the website for her newest film, hardroadofhope.com, and you can learn more about Eleanor Goldfield at artkillingapathy.com. And also like to remind folks that Eleanor Goldfield appears in the newest documentary by Project Censored, United States of Distraction. Eleanor Goldfield, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Eleanor, always a pleasure to catch up with you, and certainly have long been overdue to catch up with you. You are very busy working on multiple projects, and your most recent is called Hard Road of Hope. And it says on the website, West Virginia, that's just like the epicenter of the opioid problem, right? And home to a bunch of hillbillies who vote for Trump. And the totally corrupt politicians who just let coal and gas do whatever they want. What could you possibly have to say about West Virginia that's worth hearing? Well, Eleanor Goldfield, you went and found out. Could you talk to our listeners about your latest project?
That's what comes to mind when you hear the words West Virginia. It's the butt of jokes, right? People talk about it like it's this throwaway state. Like, the people are just hillbillies and rednecks. It doesn't matter. My point here, when I first decided that I was going to go to West Virginia, was really, well, if we're going to say that these people don't matter because they've been oppressed or propagandized, and this land doesn't matter because it's been destroyed by corporate malfeasance, is there anywhere in this country that wouldn't also be subject to that same throwaway? So that was really what inspired me to follow this story to West Virginia. And really what I found is that the propagandization about West Virginia reaches far beyond those borders of the state. And that's evidenced by how we think and talk about it. And actually, West Virginia, one of the things that really struck me initially was, for instance, the history of West Virginia, where black and white coal miners marched together in the early 20th century, actually shot at coal industry owners and barons. And not only did they not get hanged, they won some basic workers' rights. And, you know, you hear that story and you're like, I'm sorry, what? That happened in the beginning of the 20th century in West Virginia? Yeah. And that history has been buried and whitewashed and completely destroyed in West Virginia. And you see now a place that used to be proud of unions and union rights. One woman that I talked to said, if you even said the word scab around my grandfather, he'd freak out. But now they've got Trump stickers and they've got Friends of Coal stickers and things like that. And so it really speaks to the effects of amputating people from their radical history and how it is grassroots activism to build that up again and bring people to a present where they understand where they came from so as to build a radical future.
As someone that grew up in the Midwest, the so-called tri-state area, I grew up between Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia. So I grew up being very familiar with the coal industry, strip mining, strong labor. I mean, Youngstown, the little steel strike. It's really an epicenter of American labor movement work going back historically. But you're absolutely right that that's just been completely divorced from any kind of present conversations, and it's been shoved down the memory hole. And again, the perception that the corporate press tends to show and the political parties seem to play off, these are just sort of throwaway states that are good for swinging elections in the Electoral College, even though these places have been ravaged by unemployment, collapse of industry, meth, opioids, fracking. And now you're going back and telling this story of what's happening with coal. And you interviewed a great number of people here, residents, union members, people from labor museums, one of the people who's head of the organization, Keepers of the Mountain. Could you talk about how your interaction was with some of these people and how you went about finding some of these people to tell those stories?
You inspired me to tell this story because, and I grew up in the South, I grew up in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I think one of the issues that I have as an organizer is the way that it's usually white folks with a good education, which I've been privileged enough to have, but that they talk about like going into these poor white areas and having to talk down to people because, oh, they just don't understand. First of all, that's incredibly derogatory and also wrong. Just because you don't know what democratic confederalism means doesn't mean that you don't know what oppression feels like. Everybody knows what oppression feels like, even if they can't put it into this eloquent political theory language. And so the idea that you have to dumb down your language in order to interact with these people is really dangerous. And that in and of itself is stupid. And it also speaks to why people in coal country are very reticent to speak to people that self-identify as leftists or environmentalists, because they've just heard from too many quote-unquote well-meaning folks that they're evil for working in coal mines, or they're dumb because they don't understand. And that's not how you organize people. That's certainly not how you engage with people to bring them to see a perspective that you're trying to put out there. So that's really the primary point here, is that, you know, when you walk into somebody's home, you have to show them that respect and recognize where they're coming from. The adage, meet people where they're at. I have the privilege of never having to make the decision to either work in a coal mine or watch my family starve. I've thankfully never had to make that call, but people have. And then the idea of talking down to them like it's their fault that they've been put in that position is really dangerous, and it's atrocious. And it's, in my mind, why we see the propagandization of poor white communities so successful, because the racists walk in there and they'll be like, yeah, well, it's black folks' fault that you're in this position. And they'll have a beer with them on their porch. Whereas like these well-meaning white NGOs from the progressive side will just waltz in and talk down to people. So it's not surprising that poor white communities tend to lean right when the only people to reach out to them are the extreme right. And so I think that that's a main driver of this film as well, is to make clear that you have to talk to these people like people. It's not about dumbing down. It's about meeting people where they're at and them meeting you where you're at. You have different life experiences, different perspectives on life, but we can all share in the oppression of living under this corporatocracy from different angles. And that's where I was coming at it from, this place like, hey, I'm one of those journalists that you can trust kind of perspective. And I'm not out to tell your story. I want you to tell your story and I will amplify it. And that's how I go about getting these interviews. And, you know, you mentioned Keepers of the Mountain. They have done incredible work fighting mountaintop removal. We reached out to them and through them got connected with the Matewan Mine Wars Museum that, again, is doing that powerful work of connecting people to their history, which is like central and northern West Virginia, which is fracking country, had folks who basically just volunteer their time to drive folks around and show them the fracking infrastructure that's popped up around the area and how difficult it is to organize around fracking because it doesn't look as horrific as coal at first blush. So really just connecting with people, kind of popcorning from people's mutual connections, kind of like at a party or a potluck.
A couple of things that you just said there that I think are so key, and this comes through one of the things in the beginning of the film, talking about the significance of mine top removal. Given that I was from this, sort of around this region, and I'm aware of what this is, and I grew up near strip mines. I mean, when we were kids, we would go ride our motorcycles in the remains of strip mines. And in high school, people would have parties in strip mines and quarries. It was a strange part of the culture there that way. But you talked about not giving voice to the voiceless, but you talked about having platforms for amplification to allow people that already have voices to simply be louder and to be heard mm-hmm. by more people. So a big part of what you're talking about too, Eleanor Goldfield, is critical listening. And as someone that's putting together this kind of a film, you did that very well, letting the people tell those stories.
Like I said, it was super important for me because I think that this is something that happens often. Is that folks go to a place that they're like, I want to tell a story. And it's like, well, but it's not really your story, is it? You know, I wouldn't want somebody walking up to me being like, I want to tell your story. I'd be like, well, you can't tell my story. It's not yours. And so I think that it's been really important to make that distinction. Also because nobody can tell their story better than themselves. And I wanted people to relate again to these people because, as I've noted, wherever you are in this country, though it's been so brilliantly divided and conquered, you can relate to these people. Even if you've never seen a mountaintop removal site up close, you can relate to what it feels like seeing your home place or a place being destroyed by corporate malfeasance. This is truly an American experience. You know, people say that there isn't any sort of American culture that we can all share. Well, I disagree. We can all share what it feels like to live under this capitalist corporate state, obviously in varying degrees, depending on where you are and who you are, but we can all relate to that. And I wanted people to be able to recognize that and see that these are in fact very proud rednecks. The initial term of redneck, which is from black and white folks tying on red bandanas and marching together during the mine wars in the early 20th century. These are proud rednecks who are standing up for their basic human rights. And that's something that everybody can relate to and should relate to. And the idea that we can build solidarity with people that we never thought we could. Like, you wouldn't expect necessarily to be able to build solidarity with somebody who lives in the quote-unquote hills and hollers, the valleys that they call hollers, the hollers of West Virginia, if you're somebody who lives in the metropolitan area of Seattle. But you totally can, because there are shared experiences there, and there's shared power there, and that's really what I wanted to show by letting these folks share their stories and being that amplification for them.
Well, Eleanor Goldfield, I'm so glad that you brought up the history of the term redneck, because many listeners may only hear that in its co-opted derogatory format instead mm-hmm. of its historical origin. And so that's something important for people to think. And again, I think it's an invitation for people to go back and not just take a look at these regions of the country askance or just from the long view and write them off, but literally go and look at the rich history and so much of the rich history of labor, interracial struggles. That is part of the story of that area of West Virginia, of Ohio, of Pennsylvania. And I think it's important that people remember those things, and they're still going on.
Absolutely. And the tactics haven't changed either. What went on with the coal mines back in the day is they would put these different groups on different parts of the mine and have them situated in different parts of the coal town so that they wouldn't interact. Then they'd say like, oh, well, you know, the Jewish immigrants, they eat babies. And the black miners, they're savages. And, you know, these folks from Russia, they're whatever. They would craft these stories that would try and build and foster fear as opposed to solidarity, because they knew, just as they know now, what happens when people get together and say, we're not taking it anymore. I mean, just look at what's happened in Minneapolis. When people come together and say, you know what? No. Things get very uncomfortable for the powers to be. It's like that saying that our masters have a master, and that's fear. And so the coal companies knew that, and they knew the power of people who reach that threshold of oppression where they say they're not going to take it anymore. And so they tried very hard to ensure that that would never happen. And what ultimately happened is that people crossed those thresholds that had been made to divide them and reached out and said, look, we are in this together. I hear that you ate babies, but I actually don't think that that's true. So let's build together and let's fight together for our shared human rights. And we see that happening today too. The tactics of the coal industry have now become the tactics of the fracking industry. And this sort of repetition speaks to the fact that this history has been erased. Because obviously, if people recognize and hold on to this history, then there is a sense of pride in being a part of a union. There's a sense of pride in not taking the oppression of a coal company owner and things like that. But instead, what's happened is that people really are relating to their oppression now. And that's so disappointing and sad to see, but it's also so inspiring and hopeful to see folks trying to restructure that history. And that's why the film's called Hard Road of Hope, because it's not easy to hope. It's not easy to keep walking when you're getting bombarded with the oppression of the corporate state, but you do keep walking. And what makes it easier, what gives you a little pep in your step, so to speak, is to recognize that you're not walking alone, that so many people before you have walked and have fought for things that we now take for granted, like the fact that children no longer work in coal mines. I mean, one of the folks that I interviewed in the film, his grandfather started working in a coal mine when he was 10. These things that we take for granted today are things that were bitterly fought for and won because people reached that threshold of saying, no, I won't accept this anymore.
Eleanor Gold, you mentioned Minneapolis, and maybe we can get into a little bit of that after the break. I want to talk a little bit more about your film. 50 years ago, Malcolm X said, that's not a chip on my shoulder, that's your foot on my neck. And unfortunately, that quote is all too close to home given what happened in Minneapolis. But it's also the case that this is what's been happening to working people around this country in perpetuity. And there are long, hard-fought battles against it. And your film, Hard Road of Hope, shines a light on that with working people in West Virginia. I'd like to remind listeners that I'm speaking with Eleanor Goldfield. She's a creative activist and journalist, and we're talking about her recent film project. It's called Hard Road of Hope. You can see it at hardroadofhope.com. You can also see Eleanor Goldfield's work at artkillingapathy.com. I'm Mickey Huff, your host. This is the Project Censored Show. After this brief musical break, we'll continue our conversation with Eleanor Goldfield. Stay with us.
I'll bet this coal will kill me before my working days is through. In a hole that's dark and dirty, an early grave confined, I plan to make a union for the ones I leave behind. Stand up, boys, let the bosses know. Turn your buckets over, turn your lanterns low. There's fire in our hearts and fire in our soul, but there ain't gonna be no fire in the hole. There ain't gonna be no fire in the hole.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we are joined again by Eleanor Goldfield. She directed, wrote, and produced a new film called Hard Road of Hope. You can see hardroadofhope.com. But of course, Eleanor does so many things, and just want to remind listeners, she's a creative activist and journalist, and her work has appeared on Free Speech TV, Mint Press News, Roar, Popular Resistance, RT, and more. And she is co-host of the podcast Common Censored with Lee Camp. And of course, I'm a big fan of the Common Censored podcast. That's certainly something that resonates with us at the Project Censored Show. Eleanor also, of course, tours and performs and does media work and assists in frontline action organizing and activist training. So you can learn more at artkillingapathy.com. Eleanor Goldfield, before the break, we were talking about your newest project, Hard Road of Hope. And I know we have some other things we might get into, but I wanted to come back to this film. And I wanted to come back to a few of the details. For people that may be less aware, what the total impact has been, both with coal, fossil fuels, fracking, other things. The film opened up with a statistic of something like 0.8 miles wide. If you could line up mountaintops from coast to coast, from, was it New York to San Francisco?
It's from the White House to San Francisco, yeah.
Yeah, so just if you could maybe riff on a visual like that, or if there's anything that you could maybe bring out of the film to give people an idea. You're listening to these people's stories, but give us some of the maybe the environmental and political ramifications of what's happening there.
The visual there is that if you were to line up all of the mountaintops that had been, I don't even like using the word removed because it makes it sound like, oh, I removed a mole that was annoying. You're decapitating the mountains. And if you were to line up all of that, then it would be 0.8 miles wide and it would reach from the White House to San Francisco. And speaking of riveting visuals, we were able to go up in a plane above the mountaintop removal sites. And I include some of that footage in the film because you can't understand what this looks like until you see it from above, because the destruction is just so vast. Some of these mountaintop removal sites are 16 miles across. You can't even understand what that looks like until you see it from above. And even then you're like, I don't actually understand what I'm looking at. How is it possible to do this? Some of the largest earth-moving equipment in the world is used on coal mining sites. Seeing it from above gives you that perspective. And, you know, speaking of the environmental impacts, it's also important to note that, like, mountaintop removal is not the first manifestation of coal mining. Mountaintop removal is, in fact, a way of trying to scrape the last bit of peanut butter from the jar, so to speak. Because what was happening before, much like with oil drilling, we got what was easy to get by traditional drilling methods, and now we're fracking. It's the same thing with coal. Strip mining is a way to get at the coal seams that are under the top of the mountain, so to speak, as opposed to just burrowing into the mountain like you see in traditional coal mining. So the environmental impacts of traditional mining are still being felt. Mountaintop removal is just a way to amplify that even more. For instance, in one place in West Virginia, Prenter, 98% of all the inhabitants got gallbladder disease because of the poisoned water that was due to a spill that was linked to coal slurry. Now what coal slurry is it's what happens when you wash coal, and you have to wash coal because the burners don't like raw coal. They want to wash the dirt off the rock so that it burns, quote unquote, cleaner. And so what they do is they use a heavy chemical and they wash the coal rock. And then they have to do something with that dirty water, that sludge that comes off of the coal. And then what they do is they have slurry impoundments, which is basically these giant unlined earthen dams filled with this toxic sludge. And they just dump it. They dump it anywhere they can, like in the valleys next to mountains that they've decapitated. And of course, that doesn't stay there. It seeps into the groundwater. And so you get these places like Prenter, where 98% developed gallbladder disease. It destroys the ecosystems. And that's another point to bring up. Appalachia is considered one of the most biodiverse regions in the world. And when you decapitate mountains that are the source, the headwaters for these streams, when you dump this toxic sludge in the valleys between mountains, you are destroying what cannot be brought back because it's taken billions of years to create this biodiverse region. And so the environmental impacts can't be overestimated. For instance, one of the things that's mentioned in the film is the 2013 quote-unquote water crisis, where thousands of gallons of MCHM, which is a coal cleaning agent, got dumped into the water supply for 300,000 people around the area of Charleston, West Virginia. And the first thing that the governor does is get on the television and say, this has nothing to do with coal. His first aim was just to make sure that everybody knew that this isn't coal's fault. And again, this is a point that people can relate to, from Louisiana to California. The idea that industry is protected by the politicians, regardless of which side of the aisle they're on. And they want to protect it, whether that be making these chemicals trade secrets so they never tell people what's in them, or whether that be just ensuring that the industry never has to deal with any blowback because they're protected by the government. That really speaks to this pedestaling of corporate malfeasance and the protection of that corporate malfeasance by the state and allowing this disgusting level of pollution to continue. And again, this was the case under Obama. It's been the case under Trump. It doesn't matter who's there. It's protecting the market that drives coal. And even and what's really sick about it is that both Obama and Trump tried to save coal. But you can't save coal when the market says, actually, you know, oil and gas are cheaper. We don't want coal anymore, which is why, of course, you see the rise of fracking in West Virginia and other areas. And fracking has been harder to organize around because, you know, when folks come in with fracking equipment, it doesn't look like blowing the top off a mountain. It somehow looks a little less atrocious, but water's still being poisoned. Methane gas is leaking into communities. Some folks that I interviewed have talked about like the disgusting smell that you can smell when you're just going down this fracking corridor in West Virginia. They've got animals dying. They've got plants and trees dying. And the fracking industry just says, well, not our problem. Earthquakes. And then that's copying the playbook of the coal industry and repurposing it for the fracking industry.
Well, Eleanor Goldfield, a couple things. One, so desperate were the coal executives, people in the White House, whether it was Obama or Trump, and certainly politicians in West Virginia. I mean, they went so far as to talk about clean coal. There's no such thing as clean coal.
Right.
It's talking about mountaintop removal, clean coal, right? There's a doublespeak. There's a language there that conceals what's happening through euphemism. But the other thing is coming out of coal into fracking, when the frackers come to town, like you said, you don't see the same kind of obvious desecration of the land and so forth. What you see is a couple of people in suits coming to your house offering you a check for a few thousand bucks for, quote, mining rights. This was in a really devastated part of the country economically where a lot of people were reeling from a lot of these industry lost jobs. And so a lot of folks bought out. You know, they basically were like, well, the frackers are here and my neighbor took the money and they're going to frack under my ground or right next to me anyway and wreck the water supply. So if I can get a couple grand or a few grand out of it, then nothing I can do to stop it. It's amazing that they just want to pay off these people and they've literally polluted the place and caused massive health problems.
Yeah. And it really, again, like it speaks to the loss of solidarity. And they're only able to do this because people feel so isolated and forgotten. And they're like, well, you know what? Forget this. I'm not going to try and like hold down the fort. I'm not going to try and be the resistance if I don't feel that anybody has my back. They know that the politicians don't have their back. They obviously know that the industry doesn't. And so this propagandization and this powerful feeling of isolation has really driven people to feel like, yeah, well, I guess it is just me. I am that, you know, that lone ranger, the isolated stoic. And that has also, of course, driven the opioid epidemic in West Virginia, because of course, if we look at the fuel for addiction, it's very much tied to isolation, to trauma, and not having an outlet for that. And so I think like all of these issues are really tied to a loss of that solidarity that was at one point very vibrant, not just in West Virginia, but all over the United States. I mean, the labor rights movement had a strong hold in the U.S. at one point and was systematically torn apart.
Yeah. And it still is being destroyed. Anti-union movements. You know, and again, we even saw this during Obama years. We heard them saying, the right wing saying they were coming after teachers next. And they were going, I mean, again, it's a calculated onslaught that goes back not just half a century with neoliberalism. It goes back to the 19th century, literally in places like West Virginia, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, where the robber barons and the owners of the mills, if they couldn't use the public police, they hired their own private guards to smack down on the workers. I mean, this is a long, long history of oppression. And I want to also tell listeners not just to check out the hardroadofhope.com website where you can learn more or learn more about Eleanor Goldfield at artkillingapathy.com. But I wanted to call attention to the fact, Eleanor, that you included great resources at the webpage, hardroadofhope.com, where you have a lot of great organizations and West Virginia Mine Wars Museum, Blair Mountain Centennial, Keepers of the Mountain, Frack Trackers. There's a lot of really important resources on the page that went behind the film. So Eleanor Goldfield, I wanted to thank you very much for joining us on the program today. And look, there's a lot of things going on around the world that I know you have a lot to say about, but we're about out of time. So is there anything else you wanted to get in here before we slip out?
You and I could talk for days. So,
yeah.
I mean, thank you so much for having me on. And again, folks can check out the film at hardroadofhope.com. For more of the conversations that would be had, you can check out the Common Censored podcast. I also have a podcast that's every other week, Act Out. And all of that is available via artkillingapathy.com.
And your book, Paradigm Lost, right? And yes. you do music, you do art, activism. Really a renaissance person in all of the best ways, and certainly always an honor to have you on the program. And you're right, we could talk forever. I know we didn't get time to talk about what's been happening in Minneapolis and with the murder of George Floyd, but I would definitely like to have you back on here in the near future.
Yes, me too. Thank you.
That was Eleanor Goldfield, artkillingapathy.com. Her newest film, Hard Road of Hope. You can learn more at hardroadofhope.com. Thanks for joining us, Eleanor. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.
You've been tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Co-host is Chase Palmieri. Our senior producer is Anthony Fest. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. The Project Censored Show airs on roughly 50 stations around the United States, from Hawaii to New England. To learn more about our program and our work, go to projectcensored.org. We'd like to thank you, the listener, for tuning in. We'd also like if you could follow us online on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Feel free to contact us with feedback or ideas for shows at projectcensored.org. We'll see you next time.
Perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguised under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes, while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, hypnotized by the master thief. Combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu.